This year we are especially happy to have as our guest Dr. Harry DeWire, who is a member of the faculty of the United Theological Seminary in Dayton, but he is also director of the Ministry Studies Board, a national agency which has precisely this subject in view of elevating the program of training of the ministry, particularly of the Protestant churches of America. I first met Dr. DeWire years ago, 10 years ago, at a workshop of the American Association of Seminary Professors in the Practical Field, a formidable title, the organization very much seekers, because fellows like us who are trying to teach practical theology really need help. And this organization was devised to give help, and the workshop had as the editor of its proceedings, incidentally, a workbook which is still mighty useful, Dr. Harry DeWire. And the topic of the workbook and the heading to the papers was communication. 2 years afterward, there was another one, precisely the same format, by the same organization, a whole lot more papers, and this time the topic of the whole deal was the work of the minister. And it's interesting to notice that it is those two fields which are very much cognate and overlap, communication and the work of the minister, which have been the two poles of Dr. DeWire's service to the church. The members of our student body that have come from the senior college, and I guess also those on the ground, know from first-hand acquaintance Dr. DeWire's book, The Christian as Communicator. This is a key textbook in the senior college in the course in Christian Witness. And I certainly hope and pray that we haven't ruined it by making it a textbook. I have had the same experience that it's a good way to ruin a book to allow it to become a textbook. It ought to be banned or proscribed in Boston or something to make it popular. However, I'm still a little scared. I had an ear into this little conversation a minute ago, and if you've seen me skinning out in the course of this lecture, you'll know that I just can't take it, because he's going to talk a little bit about what communication is in good teaching. I'm afraid I know from the negative, and well, all of us are here to be helped. Dr. DeWire is certainly one to help us. He is the sort of person that is a walking good conscience, tremendous prestige for himself as a person, as well as his abilities up and down, back and forth across the country. And it's going to be a treasure to know him a little better because of the lectures tomorrow morning and tonight. The topic this evening is Teacher and Learner, the Principles of Communication.
Thank you. As I was growing up in a small, hard coal river town in Pennsylvania, I think it would have been a safe bet, if this is the kind of person you are, to guess that I would get as close to the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church as I have. I never had heard of it. I even, at the age of 20 plus, when I left my town to go to college, and for a few years thereafter, had mixed feelings about Lutherans in general, and no feelings about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at all. And this evening, I suddenly realized that some of my most fruitful acquaintances and associations within the past several years, and I well remember the first time I, Dr. Kemmer and I met some 10 or 11 years ago, and a more recent association with your newly appointed Dean of Students, with the Executive Director of your denomination. I seldom go any place where I feel more at home, and at the same time among people who should be rightfully very critical of what I'm going to do. Before I wrote a book on this, nobody asked me to talk about it. And then I wrote a book, said everything I know, now people ask me to talk about it. I tried in these two lectures to list out some things that I thought about after I had written the book, and especially tomorrow morning when I deal specifically with something that interests me. I am trying to carry some of the things I said a little further. But as I was working with this, it occurred to me that I might not be quite so successful as I hoped I would be. Not because there isn't a lot to say in this field of communication, but because you reach a point where not much can be said with any degree of certainty or any degree of agreement on the part of people who really look at the field of communication. At the very beginning of his work on human communication, Colin Sherry makes the observation that Leibniz in the 18th century was the last man to know everything. Up to his years, the great scholars and teachers were able to compass the whole science of their day and probably in addition, master several of the most important languages. Since that time, scientific endeavor has made it virtually impossible for any one person to have a satisfactory grasp of the many divergent disciplines which have grown up since Leibniz's time. What is more, within the disciplines themselves, we have developed something akin to scientific loneliness. Within these specific disciplines, even the sub-disciplinary concerns provide sufficient breadth to occupy a scholar his whole lifetime. Now, the field of communication is no exception to this. After 25 years of research in the field, we have come to the conclusion that we can no longer talk, if we ever could, about communication as one single system with rules that are applicable to all of its forms. It is actually a number of systems, each with its own forms and its own formulas for investigation. Imagine, if you will, a set of horizontal and vertical lines crossing each other at right angles, much like the lines of a checkerboard. The vertical lines represent the categories into which communication may be broken down and studied. Two examples of this would be the one-to-one relationship, the swarming or herding tendencies of both animals and people, talking, small group functioning, one person functioning before a large group, symposia, congresses, and a host of other forms of communication, each with its own unique dynamic system. I read somewhere where a barber had become sensitive to the fact that communication systems were changing. So he put a sign in his window, "Four Barbers, Panel Discussion." So the categories represented by these lines, these vertical lines, represent the many, many categories of communication. On the horizontal plane, however, the lines would represent the level at which communication takes place in these categories. The surface manifestations, which would occupy the top level, are well known to us, and these are subject to very broad and careful research. As simple as it may seem for us, the act of sending and receiving signals, whether by gesture or code or language, are exceedingly complex phenomena, which can easily occupy the researcher without reference to any of the other levels whatsoever. Below these surface manifestations, however, there are additional and more complex levels which affect the surface acts of communication. They are, among them, such levels as the level of the psychological set of the participants in communication, the symbolic frame of reference in which communication is cast, and the personal means to which our words and gestures refer. What you have in front of you now is a checkerboard consisting of a number of squares, each containing sufficient material for investigation in its own right. For instance, one might choose to study the one-to-one relationship, such as counseling, and in so doing, all other forms of communication of the human relationship would probably need to be at least minimized and maybe even excluded. Moreover, the study of the counseling process may be viewed or carried on at any of the levels on which communication takes place. From the standpoint of its manifest words and gestures, for instance, from the standpoint of its symbolic meaning, or in terms of any of the other levels at which communication takes place. Now, an enterprise as large as the and diverse as the Christian Church can be superimposed over this entire checkerboard. Within its life, every possible category or form of communication certainly must occur. And it functions in each one of these at every conceivable level. It would be possible, I suppose, then, to select any of the squares and talk about the communication of the gospel. Therefore, the nature of the field of communication generally makes it necessary to be very discreet and define precisely the area or the particular checkerboard, a particular square in which one wishes to work. Now, the dimensions of this lectureship have already placed certain limitations upon our choice. We are looking at the educational work of the church. As far as study of communication is concerned, this should automatically eliminate preaching. I'm going to be sorry I pushed that, I'm sure. Administration and other functions in the church's life for which the study of communication may require different treatment. But the spectrum of education within the church is still quite broad. In these two lectures, I have deliberately chosen to narrow the consideration to what is perhaps the most traditional form known to education generally, that of the relationship between a teacher and a learner. To be sure, even this relationship may occur in many forms. The lecturer to a large group of people may be engaged in the teaching-learning process. Also, the student talking to the teacher at the end of a class session is engaged in a similar process. My concern here is mainly with the teacher who functions with a manageable number of students. Exactly what this number is, I'm not willing to guess. The only criterion that I would use is that the teacher should have easy access to the emotional and spiritual life of each one of the participating learners. Now you can see why preaching could hardly fit into this category as such. It is virtually impossible to maintain this emotional and spiritual access, or to attain it. This is still not adequate. What kind of people are involved? Children? Adults? And what is the purpose of the group? Catechetical instruction? Leadership training? Church school class? These questions are extremely important, especially if our purpose would be to deal with the surface manifestation, the signs of communication. However, since we will be exploring the teacher-learner relationship at a deeper level, the nature and composition of the group might not be so important. The group we are talking about is any group which meets the conditions I've indicated above, and where the express purpose is to explore some aspect of the Christian faith. Now, so much for limiting the category of communication. We've narrowed this, we've eliminated these forms to this one in a small group setting. But now we must determine the level to be explored. I've been helped to make this decision by the useful distinction which is made in communication theory between sign and symbol. The term sign, or signal — I didn't use the word signal, which I suppose is used as much, if not more, in the literature. Terry uses it quite a bit, but signal and symbol sound so much alike, I'm choosing to use the word sign as over against the word symbol, as you will see. This refers to the physical events used in communication: words, codes, gesture, the impact of a physical setting. It asks for nothing more than the identification of the material or appropriate action which it conveys. If a teacher asks a student to name the 66 canonical books, this particular set of signs can elicit only one proper response. Although the dictionary may make the word symbol and the word sign synonymous, communication theorists are careful to distinguish between them. A symbol is different and refers to the historical, cultural, and emotional context in which the term is used. In his book, Dynamics of Faith, Paul Tillich draws a helpful distinction between these two terms in their religious usage. He accepts standard definition of sign as being that which points to a specific reality. These signs, he continues, may be replaced or modified by for reasons of expediency or convenience. On the other hand, the symbol cannot be changed unless the reality of the group which it symbolizes is completely changed. In addition, and more important, the symbol pushes the depth of the to the depths of reality which lie below the overt sign. I think in an article I wrote someplace alluded to this, that I guess maybe it was in my book, that there are — you can say the word yes and have it mean almost anything, including no. And one does not know this unless one is aware of all the nuances and the emotional overtones which are caught up in the use of the word. Thus, when a teacher asks for a listing of the canonical books, he asks for nothing different than the sign elicits. However, if he uses the Bible as symbolic language, or in a symbolic sense, he opens up all the realities of historical background, exegesis even, and its meaning for the person using it and talking about it. In other words, symbolic communication requires the teacher and the learner to invest themselves in the fundamental purpose and intention of biblical writing. Now, in Christian education, the teacher and learner are naturally engaged in the interchange of signs. They are used to acquaint the uninitiated with the history and data of the faith. But this is not sufficient as a constant teaching method, since it in no way guarantees that either teacher or learner will become a part of the reality to which these signs point. The sign helps them know the Bible. The symbol helps them understand the Word of God. The sign helps them know the church. The symbol helps them understand the community of God's people. The sign introduces them to theological concepts. The symbol opens for them the redemptive act of God in Jesus Christ. Symbolic communication, therefore, refers to a quality, and that's the significant word, a quality of relationship between teacher and learner in which the spiritual and emotional requirements for living the Christian life can be freely dealt with and expressed within terms of the reality of the Christian faith. Now, how can this relationship between the teacher and learner be so structured that this communication can take place? Answers to this question do not come easily. This probably accounts for the fact that much of the research, if not most of it, in the field of communication, is carried on at the level of the sign or the surface manifestation. Our understanding of the symbolic nature of communication has come chiefly from clinical studies, such as those carried on by Gregory Bateson and Jürgen Reusch, who have employed communication theory in therapeutic practice. In their process, the therapeutic relationship is structured, and here I quote, in such a way that the patient is exposed to situations and message exchanges which eventually bring about a gratifying social result. Is some connection with the reality or the culture in which the person has to function. The church has yet to explore in a systematic way the dynamics of symbolic communication. And until it does, we must remain in the area of generalizations and be satisfied with making some hypotheses which grow out of these observations. I would like, therefore, to suggest some of the principal characteristics of the relationship between a teacher and a learner as they work together to develop symbolic communication within the scope of their educational enterprise. I will try to describe these characteristics both in terms of the fundamental gospel and in terms of our understanding of communication theory. I'll pause here for a minute to say that one of the needs that is present is to have theologians, use that in the broadest sense, continually press for an answer to the question, does the gospel itself tell us anything about its own method of being spread abroad? Do we always have to rely upon external findings or findings in the general field, such as communication? I have the feeling this is so, and what I've said here points to the fact that we may find in the gospel itself more useful understanding of its own method than we are apt to find any other place, and simply superimpose it upon the church because it works some other place. Now, basic to our understanding of these characteristics is one hypothesis which is not commonly agreed upon by all theorists, which I believe is essential to our understanding of the teacher-learner relationship in the church. This is the theory that all communication is derived from a sense of community. Cherry then says that communication is not response, but is essentially the relationship set up by the transmission of stimuli and the evocation of response. This would seem to suggest that relationship is contingent upon the interchange of words or gesture. Within more clinical circles, however, the opposite position is generally taken, that communication is possible only after community has been established. While it is true that the transmission of signs and words contribute to the building of relationship, it is also true that before one can express himself in any way, he has to have some feeling of common urgency with the person or persons with whom he wishes to communicate. Furthermore, this position seems to be more characteristic of our understanding of the way in which the truths of the Christian faith have been arrived at. It seems hardly likely that the early church could so adequately have expressed its witness unless it arrived at a sense of community. The relationship of Jesus to his apostles made possible the interaction of ideas and feelings of guilt, confession, of the pulls and releases within the apostolic order, sponsored the signal giving and receiving, which we have recorded, and to look back of these signs and see what preceded them is every bit as important, if not more important, than saying, what do these signs produce in the way of community? One does not speak or act unless some freedom, openness, and common feeling are present to permit the words to be said or the acts to be performed. Now, in this line, we come to the first characteristic of symbolic communication. It has to do with the natural distance between the image of the teacher and the image of the learner, and the image the teacher has of the learner and the image the learner has of the teacher. A whole matter of imagery within this relationship. Now, it's perhaps unfortunate that within recent years, the image of the teacher has fallen upon hard times. The development of our concerns for group processing and educational methods has thrown the image of the teacher into eclipse. If he is dealt with at all, it is generally as an authoritarian figure whose role in the learning enterprise must be minimized. A few years ago, I was asked to go to a church, spend the weekend dealing with Sunday school, with the church school leaders, and during the Sunday morning church school hour, they asked me to sort of poke around and look at some of the things that were going on. And the minister was doing this, and he said, here we have one of the best classes in our whole Sunday school. And it was a big, big school. And I didn't walk in. They had windows in the doors, and I looked in, and I could see why. Because here was a group of 11, 12-year-old boys, quite a sizable group, and the teacher was in command, as a general proportion of Battleship Missouri, and was an ultimate authority. All of the fears and doubts and notions about the idea of the reigning supremacy of this person were carried into the notion of what it meant to sit before a teacher. And over against this, a friend of mine who teaches in New York City says, I'm always there before every pupil, and I always leave after the last one has left, and I always take my hat off. She says, I have made some inquiry, and almost all of those youngsters believe I live there. They do not believe that I come to teach. They somehow see me in the context of this. Now here you have two very extreme notions of the image of the teacher. And the first one is probably a more traditional one, and probably to our discredit much more prevalent than we would like to assume. He's uncertain in his position in the group, and he has a feeling of inadequacy in dealing with profound or even unprofound historical and theological data of the faith. And so he seeks refuge in at the level of signs. And he's safe there because there is no doubt. And if there is doubt, he can move into some other arm of the faith or into some other area and teach the sign where there will be no doubt. He can always escape the dubiousness of the reality of the faith. This is the greatest temptation of any teacher, to escape the reality of the Christian culture. And I suspect you do not need to confine this to the teacher. It is the temptation of any leader. It is easy to move to the level of signs when it gets too scary underneath. And this is especially true when the group is small enough that the teacher becomes vulnerable to the ambiguity and the doubt which may be created by their own defenseless position in front of the historical and theological data and reality of the faith. On the other hand, the learner is in the same position, really. He's unprepared to enter into this conversation adequately, not only because of the teacher's uncertainty concerning himself, but also because he is not engaged as a routine matter in the exploration of the faith. He has produced a striking distance. This has produced a striking distance between teacher and learner, which makes the attainment of the spirit of community and symbolic communication, therefore, extremely difficult, however important it may be. Now, when one tries to structure a relationship or an educational experience at this level of feeling, attitude, and spiritual concern, this both teacher and learner should be assured, or can be assured, that together they form a community. Stated more precisely, both teacher and learner guarantee the reality of each other. Now let me say something I haven't got written here, but which I believe I must say, that probably if the teacher and learner cannot guarantee the reality of each other in a communitarian sense, there is no true Christian education. The learner is not someone against whom the teacher has to struggle. The teacher is not a prestige figure to be endured, feared, or placated. Where only is the signs and realities of the religion must be learned, the distance between a teacher and learner might not be a major factor. In fact, if we can trust what teaching machine people are saying to us, we can look forward to the elimination of the teacher altogether in the task of teaching the signs in our religion. The fact of the matter is, William Dowman has just given the American Association of Theological Schools enough money to do some research on the use of teaching machines to teach biblical language. And what this only has one conclusion, that is, that a man who teaches Greek in a theological school, or Hebrew, may be out of a job if all he can do is teach Hebrew. As Hebrew. Now what we know is that some other things can happen, but at least this is what we're in for. And we know for a fact that these machines, if they can be relied on at all, in our church school, in any place where these things need to be learned, they can do a much better job than a teacher, because they have found out, Human Relations Institute found this out, and who else is some of the Collier Corporation, that these machines are a lot more patient than teachers. That is, they don't argue back. They just say, turn back two pages and look again. And you keep on going until you have this. They don't show any kind of emotion, and the student is drawn into this, and they learn much quicker, much faster, much quicker, and much more permanently by the teaching machine method. Now, the rise of interest in this for the church is going to threaten a great many people, because we're going to have to find a new justification for the teacher as a teacher. Now, we ought to remind ourselves that in the context of the church, the teacher has always been responsible for a whole lot more than the simple transmission of the content of the faith from one generation to another. And if the teacher is deprived of this task, he may then be driven to ask the very question that we're asking here: what is he to do in the interpretive, symbolic level, at the interpretive, symbolic level, where true communication of the faith takes place? The teacher holds a crucial position here, and this position is, in the first place, to build this community. He stands within a context of the tradition and in the presence of the person with the express purpose of providing a relay of meaning between them. What the church means, what the learner is, comes to some meaning in the teacher. The tradition means something to him. The learner means something to him. One cannot overestimate the position the teacher holds in such a relationship. He runs tremendous risks and must learn to live with weakness, even failure. It may be easy for him to say what things mean. It is much more difficult for him to be meaning. And the accomplishment of this depends not only on his skills of teaching, but upon the knowledge one has of either the person or the tradition, but as well upon the degree to which the teacher is able to bear within himself the gospel and attributes of the community to which he gives witness. Or as Paul says, it is the Spirit himself bearing witness with us in our spirit that we are children of God. You see. Now, when the teacher seeks to become this reality, he does what Martin Buber terms he presses for the mutual experience of inclusion. He has an interesting little chapter on education in his book, Between Man and Man, which is worth reading. For the learner, the teacher must really be there. If I can take a moment to talk about some of the other areas in which the communication is so important in the more or less practical fields of the offices of the church. The larger the group a person is talking to, the farther away he seems to have to become. Preaching is a fairly good example. Almost all the deliberate work that one does to prepare to preach, and to get dressed to preach, and to get up to preach, each step moves him farther and farther away. That is, what preaching very often seeks for is mutual exclusion. The amount of feedback one get in preaching a sermon can hardly ever, in fact, I don't know when ever, it can be gotten in the act of preaching itself. Gotta wait till afterward, if it happens at all. It would be very, very unexpected to have the feedback immediately. You can always tell some things if everybody's quiet, but then there's a risk to just have them hypnotized. You know, aren't really preaching, have them hypnotized. The little boy said to his daddy, "Daddy, what will we do if he gets out of there?" That's not the end of it. The father said to the little boy, "Don't worry, he never does." So that this act of the mutual experience of inclusion is what the teacher presses for in symbolic communication. He must really be there. He does not need to possess the perfections the learner may think he possesses. To use Buber's words, if the teacher has, quote, really gathered the child into his life, then that subterranean dialogic, that steady potential presence of the one to the other is established and endured. There is a reality between them. Now, attaining this state of communion within the church's existing educational structure is frustrated by many factors, chiefly that of time and continuity of relationship. However, within the given structure, some things might be done. Basic task of preparing for a group session, for instance, the teacher can immediately solicit the aid of the learner in the completion of his own preparation. In most instances, and here I personally am vulnerable, just as your own teachers are vulnerable, because being a teacher, I guess I'm doing some personal witnessing here. The conversation between student learner and teacher begins too late, generally after the teacher has satisfied himself that he has answered all of his questions. Usually, moreover, at the end of his preparation, the teacher may even find himself tempering or tailoring his questions to satisfy the answers that he has arrived at or is willing to live with. He doesn't let the question stand. Now, at the level of feelings, or in communicating with feelings and attitudes, as little as possible should be done by the teacher without reference to the learner and without the learner's knowledge of this reference. The teacher comes to the learner not with something he has done for the learner, but with something which, without the learner's help, he cannot finish. That's community. In other words, the teacher picks up the learner at the point of the problems and not at the point of the answer. Now, this leads to a second characteristic of symbolic communication: the guarantee of the survival and authenticity of the spiritual life of both learner and teacher. It's a mistake, I think, to assume that the learner brings no preparation to the relationship. Imagine what might happen in the minds of the teacher and pupil during a week between church-school sessions. Let's use this for an example. The learner, on the one hand, probably makes no preparation, at least not by conscious intention, for the following Sunday. However, the very nature of his life forces him into the spirit and act of theologizing. He is required to keep afloat in a world of conflicting demands, and if his religious training has any influence upon him whatsoever, these demands will require a Christian interpretation and answer. These experiences are personal, authentic, and spiritual.
His religious growth can be assured only if his encounter with the teacher makes use of his own private preparation. Now, the teacher, on the other hand, has other ideas about his responsibility during the week. He must prepare something. He engages himself in the discipline of theological inquiry. He has blocked out for him and the learner, generally by some other party. The areas of concern which fit into other areas to form a curriculum that guarantees adequate coverage of the life and thought of the church. He feels responsible for this material and for the learner's understanding of it. His attention is focused upon an academic process which, on the coming Sunday, he can couple with the best educational method and produce a good lesson. Strangely enough, however, during his week, the teacher cannot avoid theologizing either. He must bring the demands of his life into terms with his Christian convictions. But as a rule, these experiences and feelings rarely make a substantial contribution to what he plans to say Sunday morning, especially if his private concerns are unrelated to his academic preparation. Now here you have the making of this reinforcement of mutual survival and authenticity. But it isn't you. Both of these people are doing something real. Now, I believe I'm aware of all the dangers facing us if complete spontaneity were to be the sole governing factor in Christian education. A teacher were in a relationship which relied only upon whatever could be initiated in personal experience would become inbred and hostile. However, the dangers we run in excluding the vital and authentic spiritual concerns of these individuals, both of them, from the relationship are just as great. For both teacher and learner, these are the only true gifts they have to give each other. And it is only through their expression, the giving of these gifts, that they can carry on a spiritual or a symbolic dialogue. Now, these two characteristics of communication, its roots in community and its concern for personal witness, leaves us with a further and final question. Exactly of what is this communication symbol? Symbols are culturally and historically derived. They depend upon a continuity of meaning that can be trusted to validate both the spirit of community and our own personal witness. Now, let's not forget what I said earlier, that the symbol cannot change. If it's a true symbol, it cannot change unless the nature and form of the entire culture in which it gets its meaning is changed. For Christian education, the only possible cultural rootage is the church. Its witness and its performance in the midst of transient and competing culture. If our educational task requires us to deepen the levels at which we explore our spiritual life together, then more must be demanded of and learned from the church and its traditions. We will need to learn not only what it did, but what comfort, assurance, and edification it provided and provides for its children. Is it possible to teach this church, and you describe it here very briefly, symbolically? And before an answer is attempted, we ought to see what we mean by this. What's back of the concept? What do these structures mean as they relate? In fact, how do we teach the meaning of the church? Now, whether this can occur depends entirely, almost again, on the way the teacher functions as a teacher. And I've chosen the symbol here of the artisan. The teacher as an artisan, as over against maybe a practitioner. The artisan draws the learner into a dramatization
of the tradition and into a reenactment of the events of the faith. In reality, this is the church, the teacher-learning, the teacher-learner relationship within the context of the church is the church. Now we've got to rely on what we have at our disposal. The church, much like love, faith, and other fruits of the Spirit, is it undefinable and elusive and even maybe unknowable, but we'll try to know it anyhow. Now, it's difficult to set up a mythology, a methodology based on upon symbols. The only thing that can be said about it for certain is that what takes place will depend much more on the feeling tone which the teacher can create in a group than on the specific act of the teacher. The plausible words of wisdom are undergirded with a, quote, demonstration of the spirit and power. Now, how is this done? Well, the number of techniques open to us is somewhat limited. We've discovered just about all we need to know. We're going to learn about educational concepts, and it seems to me we don't need any new so-called techniques to improve our teaching. So let's look at some of the old ones. First, the environment itself can be structured so that the tradition of the church can be observed. The drama needs to be seen. I guess what I want to challenge here is the notion that Rousseau was quite prevalent in the more yeasty years of Christian education. Men like Bauer and Eliot Chase, and even back as far as Cole, who I guess was a teacher of all these fellows. What I'm objecting to is the supposition we have that the school of the church is first a school. I don't believe I can agree. I would rather think that the first impulse the teacher has about his function in the school, in the school of the church, comes through the church and not through his feeling of it as being a school. It needs to be looked at both by both learner and teacher in this way. Now, teacher may use a lot of things, a lot of words, pictures. But what should be here is an observation of the church, as nearly as it can be duplicated, within this simple and small group of people. The teacher is under obligation not only to let his word be a way in which this process is formed, but also introduce the learner to, by letting him observe, what the church really is. Its creed, biblical language, prayer, and the records of the yearning and searching of the saints. In other words, the whole range of theological terminology and thought are there. There are very few theological concepts that cannot be demonstrated. One exception to that is the Trinity. And I thought about that coming over here. I don't know how one would go about expressing in life the Trinity. I think maybe it can be done. If you have any ideas, I'd be glad to hear them. But a few that are difficult, maybe because they are still part of the mystery above this expression. But most of the theological concepts, most of the things the church says about itself, can be demonstrated, observed, and felt.
And the community, which is built by a teacher who stands as this relay of meaning between the church and between the learner, helps to provide a kind of an arena in which these notions it has of itself and all of the thought forms which have developed to describe its meaning can be observed, not simply at the level of sign, but at the level of symbolic or emotional activity. Now, the second symbolic method is that of participation. Christian education is more than observation or observance. It is drama. As we said, even the most difficult dogma tradition, both learning it and being it at the same time. Now, what this creates is a certain tension. And this tension is twofold. One, at the first level of the, in the first place, it tends to be very gratifying. Community makes a person feel easy. But in the second place, this reverence and acceptance of it is accompanied by a feeling of frustration. For the dogma becomes exceedingly restrictive when it assumes that all the meaning for life has been fulfilled in the past. Frustration is implicit in the very nature of the Christian faith. Its essential dualism, its enigma, and the embarrassment engendered by man standing in their midst as built into the Christian faith, this necessary ingredient for growth. I like the limits of the Christian faith. I do not like the limits of the Christian faith. So, both teacher and pupil must learn the act of tolerating this ambiguity and ultimately invite the critique. Christian education has three component parts. Among other things, planning, executing, evaluating. We do the first two very well, we do the last one very poorly. We are so happy when we get something finished that we don't always take time to ask, how well did we do it? There is always something else to be done. As Abraham Maslow says, it's what we have just done tells us what we must continue to do. We don't stop to ask whether it was worthwhile doing, especially in the church. My particular, the arm of the faith to which I belong, has in the past, we've sort of gotten away from it a little bit, has protracted meetings. These are evangelistic efforts by which we seek to win the lost and redeem the unredeemed. Now, one of the interesting things that we notice about this, that there has never been an unsuccessful one. It may be you don't have any souls saved. What you do is say, oh, we sowed a lot of seed. Or the spirit was good. The church's evaluation chiefly consists of some form of apology. We don't actually say it. Now, did it work? Now, this probably is because we have not built into the community its own critique. There seems to be a finality about the creed, about our church, about the thought forms, that they should always work, that they should always be successful. And we need, and just like always, we need to pay some attention to what it means in the teacher-learner relationship to unlearn, to bring fulfillment to the book of Acts, so to speak. That we need to involve both teacher and learner as they discuss with each other, not only in observing the pageant, not only in participating in it, but seeing themselves as the writers of it. Continuing to make this dialogue not simply a reiteration of what the church has done, but where the church is going. And if this critique is taken seriously, and if we maintain a community and integrity, and the teacher stands between the pupil and
culture, as the church, with an endeavor to communicate at the level of emotion, a fellowship will be provided, and the church will be born. A lot of research needs to be done on this. We need to learn how to. We need to learn what we to observe, see what actually goes on between student and teacher and learner. As I said, we need to learn what it means to evaluate our communication. In small groups, we have someone who listens. I was in a small group not long ago where one fellow did nothing. He was told to do nothing but keep quiet. And for 10 minutes, listen to what was said, and then after we were through, tell us what we said. Now, either he didn't hear what we said, or we didn't say what we thought we did, because it didn't sound like what we said. He didn't sound like what we were talking about. Then we asked him, well, what did you see going on? What kind of sparks were flying around? And he had a lot to say about this, because there were sparks. So the evaluative process is important. The other problem which I think needs some attention is the one with which I want to deal tomorrow, and that is that communication is tremendously frustrated by the fact that we are so prone to conceal things from one another. So I want to deal with this process of learning and teaching and what it means in terms of the concealment of the notions about ourselves and about the Christian faith.
I'm learner. The problem of concealment, Dr. Harry DeWine.
Thank you, Dean Rep. My fellow seminarians. I rather suspect there are some of you here today who were not here last evening. And I feel somewhat anxiety-ridden because I'm not sure what I have to say today will have as much meaning to you as it might have had if you had heard what I had to say last night. Now, that's what I want to make myself feel, but probably I can, as I go along, fill in some of the places where what I did say last evening may hope to beef up the points I wish to make this morning. The relationship between a teacher and a learner has many kinds of problems, especially if we want to push the level of inquiry below the surface manifestation of what goes on. The teacher may, in any number of ways, develop techniques which will satisfactorily indoctrinate or teach and cause learning to take place. If by this, we propose to simply make the learner acquainted with the data of the faith. If, however, we wish to make the teacher-learner relationship a vital and meaningful experience and a duplication of whatever the Christian faith means in terms of its, what we called last evening, its symbolic nature, then the problems become more intense and more confounded. The chief problem, I suppose, is the problem of the hidden agenda which every teacher and every learner brings into the relationship. And this hidden agenda I have chosen to call concealment. That is, we have our private, authentic lives. The degree to which we permit these to be displayed in any relationship is significant to the quality of the relationship. Now, in the arena of Christian education, which takes place within the context of church, it is relatively simple, I suppose, to learn and teach the signal or the surface aspects of the faith. But there are a host of other dynamic elements which seldom emerge, but which ought to emerge simply because of what the church is. Such things as confession, guilt, sacrifice, even love. We may learn that the cross stands for something, but we may not learn that the cross means something. And until the meanings become a part of the teacher-learner relationship, the total effect and implication of the gospel has not become a part of the educational enterprise. Now, if this is to occur, the responsibility is going to fall almost 100% upon the teacher. As I said last evening, the teacher is persona non grata in the world. They're underpaid, underprivileged, someone people struggle against. They're put in caricature in such a way that they do not fully get to the learner as being something he would like to negotiate with. So that the teacher-learning relationship in our culture does not have a good sound. Now, this carries over into the church, obviously. And as long as a teacher sees himself in this role, he won't be able to escape the drag upon his responsibilities which such a concept provides for him. He will then, in the church, only teach confession. He will not hear it. He will be satisfied simply to describe the act of love. Little John gave little Mary a piece of his candy. He will not be prompted to develop a situation in which love becomes an integral part of what he is doing. Now, in order to develop the symbolic language and function at the level of the symbols of the faith, the teacher and learner are going to have much more access to each other. What is it that tends to prompt this concealment or this hidden agenda in the learner as well as in the teacher? First of all, by virtue of his recognized immaturity, the learner can never be certain that his questions or meanings will be accepted. In no other group in our culture does a person feel the results of enculturation at such an early age as he does in the church. A normal Sunday church school, if you look at it over a long period of time in terms of one child, is gradually a narrowing experience. Children do not behave, so to speak. They're vigorous, curious, struggling against the teacher, if nothing else. But after a while, they soon learn one of two things. Either how to accommodate themselves to the answers, or not to accommodate themselves to the answers and find their relationships at another point in the culture. So that our psychological need to feel at home tend to make us cautious in the church. The living may even feel that it is a violation of the temper of the community to raise questions which he has never raised before, no matter how pressing they may be upon his own conscience. Now, the letter can conceal also because of the nature of the church's educational task, which is so constructed that it is very difficult for the learner to become sufficiently oriented within the community to raise the essential questions of feeling. There is just not enough time to provide the kinds of reinforcement and support for the expression of meaning. In fact, one might say that during the 7 days between the one-hour sessions in which most learners in the church are in session, more is lost in the way of homogeneity than is gained in the hour he has with the teacher. Concealment, therefore, becomes a product of the lack of one vital connection with the thing that should sponsor the freedom of the person. The third reason for concealment is that the teacher himself and his relation to the learner is a peculiar factor in our day. In the long history of the association with teachers, the student had learned that he is in what the Overstreets have called an over-under relationship. Fact of the matter is, if you tend to examine your lives, you will find that this over-under relationship is a very dominating quality in our communication. Something happened to me within the last couple of months which demonstrated this so well that I can't refrain from letting you in on it. When I was a boy, up to the time I finished high school and somewhat beyond, I was a stutterer, a rather serious speech block which got in the way of a lot of things in my life. I won't tell you why this all was. First of all, I'm not sure I knew. No. Secondly, even if I did, it's none of your business. But gradually, through one way and another, I tended to overcome it and had practically forgotten about it. 2 months ago, my mother passed away, and she was buried in my hometown, which I had had little contact with over the past 30 years. We went to this little town, my family, and also my family of orientation, as well as my family of procreation, and went to what passed for the hotel. I walked up to the desk and gave my name, and the girl looked at me and at the card with my name and recognized me as being in her class in high school some 30 years before. And when I answered her, I stuttered, rather shaking, grown up man to do things like this. But now part of this was due to the feelings I know I had then about the over-under relationship. One tends to feel under to certain kinds of people in certain relationships. And it just so happened my underness at this point was creeping out on me. The teacher, the learning situation, has about it many superior factors, striving factors, which, if the learner feels incapable of attaining, he is apt to respond by concealment. This is traditional in the school environment. This is what we have taught school to be: a series of over-under relationships which never quite become resolved. Now, we talk about the church, but it makes little difference, it seems, that the school is being conducted under the church's aegis. The fact is still there, this unresolved over-under factor. The student knows he must be receptive
and teachable, and expects the teacher to be demanding and ultimately give some evaluation to his behavior and his rate of learning. Now, the fourth reason is that the student may feel that certain things should take place in the church, and these things have to do with good. The church, in the mind of most people, is the redeemed aspect of their experience. That is, they go to church with a feeling of growing up and getting into the gathered life of the Christian community, which gathered life represents the Christian experience at its best. And in the best situation, one is careful to conceal the worst. It is not clearly understood nor taught that the church is at the same time a community of the redeemed, but also a community for the redemptive act to occur. Now, we can't forget our shortcomings and needs when we come into the gathered life of God's people, but they are very privately held and secretly dealt with, if dealt with at all. They do not become the matter of group concern. Now, these are a few of the reasons. The very nature of what we are doing tends to enhance and prompt concealment. The teacher's reasons for concealment are not much different, I expect. He's grown up in the same church, developed similar notions about the community of God's people and about what the teacher is in his culture. He may not actually know the students he teaches. He seems to be in a highly structured and unnatural situation and makes the best of whatever he has at his disposal for engaging his group in the discussion of the things which he can predetermine. So that gradually teacher and learner occupy two levels. The teacher at the level of authority and control, the student at the level of submission and even suffering. Now, this is tragic, especially if we conceive the church to be the point at which the actual relationship between people ought to be a redemptive experience. And if, as I said, this is going to change, it will have to rest upon the teacher to make the change. The teacher who exercises what I call here the fake control, from which this group cannot escape anywhere. The teacher structures the environment. He determines the direction the discussion is going to go, and he ought to assume that, not assume that his role should be minimized. Now, how does he go about this? Now, pay attention to an exceedingly helpful chapter in Emil Brunner's work, Christianity and Civilization, second volume, in which he deals with the growth of education throughout the history of the Western society, beginning with the Socratic theory, which called attention to the educational possibilities lying within the person. Here is where you, to put it in more modern form, you unfold that which has been enfolded. All you need to do is provide the right kind of pipeline and the right kind of contact with what is inside, and everything that's inside will come out. We place a lot of emphasis upon this in other forms today, not so much in education, but in counseling. If you can't have an experience of catharsis in a Sunday school class, see the minister on Thursday evening at 6 o'clock, and there you can have it, you see. And as a result, most ministers today are simply beleaguered with people who want to talk about this. And what we don't sense is that they want to talk about it to the minister because the church has, to some extent, failed its task to make this a part of its ongoing educational work. Now, this is
This is hanging on as a kind of a theory of what the teacher should do. Simply provide, like I saw on television not too long ago, this contest in which people take 40 pounds of granite and try to skid it down 100 feet of ice and knock somebody else's 40 pounds of granite out of the way. In front of this thing, there run two people with brooms. That's what the teacher does. Sort of clear the way, and this kid will do all right. It's not so, says Brunner, that this mimetic method is an improvement over the fact, probably, that somebody can pour into somebody else what they ought to know. But the appearance of Christianity on the scene, Brunner says, seemed to hold an answer. And that is that somehow or other, the formation of these people into a seeking, questing community, which has a common notion and an interchange of meaning about what has occurred to them, this provides for the possibility of correction for this basic Socratic method. But it didn't do it. At first it appeared that Christianity introduced into the world the corrective for this kind of approach to human life. But unfortunately, the crystallizing of thought of the early fathers concerning what did happen in first century Palestine and Asia Minor immediately sent the church into even the period before Socrates, in which the teacher held all the reins. Now, what is it today, then, that we need to seek for? The teacher will not succeed in uncovering the concealed areas unless the teacher views himself as a minister. The figure of the teacher is inadequate. It cannot do the job of unlocking the hidden agenda. Only when the teacher becomes minister does he have a chance of becoming successful in doing this kind of unlocking. Now, it is both then the teacher's responsibility to provide as minister not only a method by which he functions, but also a mood or a climate in which the functioning takes place. Let's speak, first of all, to the point of the method. The method of the teacher, as long as he's a teacher, will always be that of monitoring. Now, I don't need to tell students this. They're being looked at. Someone has his eye on you until the grades are given. And this kind of under-relationship is threatening. I've been interested in a study made by two people, Hal Kelly and Kenneth Ring, which study was reported in the Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology 2 years ago, in which they have tried to develop a teaching method, or research out a teaching method which may get around this matter of monitoring and assist the student or the learner to do his own monitoring. The teacher, in other words, is looked at not only as a monitoring element in the situation who teaches something else, but also in the monitoring situation teaches monitoring as an inner control. They set this experiment up, and I want to read it because I think it will help you to see how they went about it and what they were looking for. The trainer or the teacher has available several courses of action. He can assume that the learner made the correct choice and reward him. We do. Or he can assume that he has made the incorrect choice and punish him. or he can disregard the situation and do nothing. The first course of action is likely to conceal behavior because, as I said earlier, after a while, we learn to trust ourselves in the presence of the teacher only with what we can be sure will be rewarded. As long as a trainer, as long as a learner can obtain reward, if the teacher fails to see his actions, he will have no reason to learn to show them to the trainer or to the teacher. He can obtain positive outcomes by making either the correct response publicly or the wrong response privately. On the other hand, while the second approach seems to be unnecessarily punitive and rather cruel, it is likely to have advantages from the point of view of encouraging the trainer to keep trying, to continue to bring his behavior to the teacher. The punishment would tend to discourage any tendencies towards concealment because other factors come to work which press for reinforcement and so on. The discomfort can be avoided and reward attained with certainty only by making the correct choice and presenting evidence of it to the trainer. Now, the third course of action is intermediate to the in these respects. The trainer's inaction encourages neither hiding nor showing. However, insofar as the learner finds the incorrect behavior intrinsically more rewarding, the learner will find concealment to be advantageous. Under these conditions, the teacher's action in the absence of monitoring information would be expected to have effects similar to giving a reward. Now their findings bear this out. The subjects working under what they call the suspicious learner, a suspicious teacher, appear now more willing to bring their choices to the attention of the teacher and in addition express a greater feeling of control over the teacher's action toward them. One school of training of psychiatrists, I believe it is, the teacher never says anything about a report that's brought in until the student says something first, simply to enhance this quality of self-monitoring. Now, the term here is not a good one, suspicion. But it's exactly what its purpose is to be. Its purpose is to be the moving of trust. That is, what can you rely upon in the church? Moving this from the teacher or from some external source to the student himself, who at the same time has the support of this community and access to the historic faith which gives him then the assurance he needs to function in this way. What this really means, that by the teacher's own nature, he does not accept without monitoring anything he does or the learner does. But these are only two steps in the three-step process. The final and most important step is the construction of the mood, an attitude of the group in which the learner will learn to accept this monitoring without the fear of being rejected or the fear of being denied his true self. He does not inquire as a learner, hardly ever, as to what it is that keeps the teacher afloat as a Christian in the non-Christian world. This is a fair question, but it never gets asked. Why does the teacher teach? We know why the learner learns. He needs to learn. But why does the teacher teach? What elements in his own experience are valuable because he is a teacher and because he has accepted this responsibility? We have no intention as learners, really, of turning the teacher back upon himself, so that
The teacher not only is a monitor, but he is helping.